My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 5th, 1987, and my home group is the West Portland Group in Portland, Oregon. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me to do this. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in my own recovery. And hi, my name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. And it's good to see a lot of friends that I know from all over the country down here, and some friends of mine from Southern Oregon, the Southern Oregon Dogs on the Roof group, and a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I drank for 11 years, and for whatever reason, in those 11 years, it regressed very rapidly. I was somebody that in those 11 years, I was arrested 15 or 16 different times for alcohol-related arrests. I had 3 DUIs, 2 treatment centers. I was somebody that would get the DTs when I was coming off of alcohol. I went to 2 treatment centers. I was a daily drinker the majority of my drinking career and ended up becoming a daily oblivion drinker. I was unemployable towards the end of my drinking. I was somebody that essentially was living to drink. And just to give you an idea where my head can still go sometimes today, I was speaking a couple years ago at a meeting, and before I went up to speak, I was thinking about how I was going to start off. And I was standing out, kind of outside, and I was like, okay, 15, I kind of went through that list, you know, kind of the highlights or the lowlights of my drinking. And I was like, okay, 15, 16 alcohol-related arrests. I went to bed on a regular basis as a blackout drinker. You know, 2 treatment centers, detoxes, hospitalization for alcohol withdrawal, so forth, so on. And then at the end of that, a little voice in my head said, you know, maybe you're not really an alcoholic. But I did recoil from that thought as if from a hot flame. And that wasn't necessarily always true. There was a time in my life where that was the exact sort of thought that would precede me believing that this time was going to be different, that I could take a drink, and even though whatever I had done the night before, whatever pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralizing thing, or you know whatever it was, this is going to be different, and here's how. And because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and taking actions that seemed to have no relevance to my problem and being involved in the fellowship, I don't have those kind of thoughts, and it's been some time since I've had that kind of thought. I was somebody that, when I wasn't drinking, I always felt a little bit different than other people. I felt separate and apart from. I had this this sense of isolation and loneliness. When I look back at my story, I feel like I almost died of loneliness. I mean, I just, you know, even when I was amongst people, I was lonely. And with that kind of bred this fear of people and this constant anxiety when there was nothing to be anxious over. And ultimately there became some depression when there was nothing to be depressed over. And no matter how hard I tried to be like other people and tried to fit in with other people, I always seemed to be on the outside. It seemed as though there was all of them and there was me. And alcohol gave me relief from that. A certain amount of alcohol, my magic numbers were 8 to 10 drinks. 8 to 10 drinks made me feel like what I thought other people felt normally. And I would get relief from those drinks. Now it says in the book that that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect. I love the effect. It was magic for me. Very similar to what Chuck mentioned this morning. I went from somebody who had all this malady and so forth, and when I would take those 8 to 10 drinks, it was as if my shoulders would come down, and I'd just go, and I could go out and start participating in life. Now, the truth is that if those 8 to 10 drinks, if I could have stopped at those 8 to 10 drinks, and maintained what those 8 to 10 drinks would have done for me, I'd be out drinking my 8 to 10 drinks tonight. The problem is that I suffer from that phenomenon of craving, and that once I get a certain amount of alcohol in my system, that I drink to try to overcome that craving, and I would ultimately, you know, overdrink and drink into ultimately to oblivion. Right from the start, I had trouble with alcohol. Like I mentioned, I was a daily drinker the most of my drinking career. I started off primarily as a gin and bourbon drinker. I ended up being just a beer drinker. Or not just a beer drinker. I drank beer and everything else, but my primary thing was beer. I had ran away from home when I was young. I got kicked out of high school. I got my first DUI when I was 16 or 17 or something like that. I was arrested the first time for an alcohol-related offense when I was 14 or 15. Stole the car and ran away from home and did a bunch of stuff. And then when I got kicked out of high school, I grew up in a kind of an upper-middle-class suburban neighborhood of Portland, Oregon. And my father came from a lumber town in Oregon. He was from a logging family. And his thing was with me is get an education, whatever you do, don't become a logger. So when I get kicked out of high school, I became a logger. And the logging industry is full of professional drinkers, and I stood out as a drunk amongst professionals. And it was a great occupation for a drinker, because you'd work all day, you'd drink all night, you'd come to in the morning, in the middle of the night actually, because you had to catch a bus out to the woods again. But you wore the same clothes day in and day out, you didn't have to shave, you didn't have to bathe, and you could just kind of drink and work. And I fit perfectly in that sort of environment. And I did that until I couldn't do it anymore. In the fall of 1986, I was no longer working in the woods logging. And by this time, I was already making attempts to control my drinking or to stop drinking altogether, you know, and all sorts of attempts. I used to write out plans on like 5x8 cards about how I was going to drink, you know. Okay, I'm only going to drink on Thursdays and Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays. Unless there's a woman involved, then I'll drink. And, you know, one of those plans, I remember I was riding a bus from Portland down to Ashland, and because I'd lost my driver's license, and I used to get like a light bulb that would go off in my head. It's like, okay, if I only drink this way, and I started writing it down. Okay, if I drink this way, then I'll be okay. And so I mapped out exactly how I was going to drink. And this particular map of drinking or plan of drinking did not include weekday drinking. This was on a Wednesday. Well, there was a layover on the bus ride in Eugene, and within 5 minutes of the layover, I was in the bar drinking. And it was just like plan after plan after plan, and I would return to drinking. In the fall of 1986, I had a conversation with myself, and I said, you know, I've been fighting this alcohol for some time. And, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm not going to fight it anymore. I'm a drinker. And I'm just going to start, you know, I'm going to drink when I feel like drinking. I'm not going to try to control it any longer. I essentially surrendered to alcohol. And for the next 3 weeks, I drank to blackout on a daily basis. And I would, to unconsciousness or blackout, and I'd come to each morning. And at the end of that 3 weeks, I thought to myself, my God, I wonder if I'm ever going to be able to stop this. And the next thought was, I don't care. This is the happiest I've ever been. Surrendering to alcohol and drinking to oblivion on a daily basis was absolutely the best I'd ever been in my entire life. They say that alcoholism is the only fatal progressive disease that has a fun phase. And that was my fun phase. But it was short-lived. That type of drinking only lasted for about a couple months, and then the problems started stacking up again. And once again, I was going through my normal routine, but now I crossed over a line. And the line was I was drinking that way. I was a daily drinker prior to this, but I was now a daily oblivion drinker, and I couldn't slow it down. I couldn't shut it back off. I couldn't get back. And I kind of started coming to each day with you know, that sense of impending doom. And by this time, I started having this sense of impending insanity. I thought I was going crazy. And I come to with guilt, shame, and remorse, which is, seems to be the way that I came to every morning, regardless of what the night before was like, whether I had, you know, done some sort of pitiful thing or whether I'd just gone out and gotten drunk. And I would come to, and I would wake up with the shakes and the sweats, and I couldn't determine whether it was cold or hot, you know. And I wasn't somebody that shook, you know, physically like this, but I had these tremors on the inside. And I also had a lot of auditory hallucinations when I'd come off alcohol. I was somebody that when I was coming off alcohol, I would be kind of standing around or walking somewhere, and I'd hear organ music from somewhere behind me. And then at the end of the organ music, I'd hear this, Chris. And I'd turn around, and nobody'd be there, and I'd walk a little bit further, and I'd hear some more organ music somewhere off in the distance, and I'd hear, Chris. And I'd turn around again, and then it dawned on me. It's like, oh, yeah, that's a... I didn't know anything about alcohol withdrawal. I literally thought that that was just a normal part of a hangover. Everybody hears voices when they have a hangover. I had no idea that it was a part of alcohol withdrawal. But I would put myself together the best I could in the morning, and I would have a plan for the day. And I'm done. I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I'm not going to drink. And then sometime later in that day, my mind, you know, that obsession, that insanity that precedes the first drink would start working on me. And it could be a very elaborate plan where it said, yeah, I told you I'm not coming back there with you. It could be an elaborate plan that was a well-detailed, thought-out plan, like I'm only going to drink a glass of water in between each drink. You know, and believe that, you know. And the only thing that ever did is I wet the bed earlier in the night than I normally would. Or it may just be, screw it, I'm drinking. And I'd be drinking. And I did that day in and day out and day in and day out. In June of 1986, I came to one morning. I was living in Ashland, Oregon. And it was in Ashland. It has heat, which for me being a Portlander, heat is any time it goes about 100. It's nothing here, but... coming 2 in the morning in Ashland with that 100 or 105 degree weather and shaking to death in that heat and just being sick. And I came 2 this morning and I started patching the blackout, you know, the pieces of the night together. And I was like, I had that shudder of like, oh my God, I did that last night. And at the time, I was desperately trying to quit drinking. I was reading the book Under the Influence. I was reading other stuff on alcoholism, you know, more medical type books. And I was just like, I got to get out of here. I can't do this. I'm, you know. And so I got out on the freeway and I hitchhiked to Portland. And my plan was, I was afraid of the DT, so my plan was is I was going to wean myself off of alcohol. And so the first night I drank like 6 or 7 beers, and the second night I drank like 4 or 5 beers, and then the third night I drank 2 or 3, and then the fourth night I think it was something like that, and the fourth night I didn't drink anything. And on the second night I got attacked by a rodent in my bed, and I was just starting to doze off when this rodent attacked me, and it was definitely a rodent. I mean, I saw it as real as life attacking me in the bed. The next morning, however, I'll tell you the way my alcoholic mind worked is I thought, did I have the DTs last night? And then I thought, no, I think that was a dream. And then I thought, yeah, I'm probably not an alcoholic because that was probably a dream. That probably wasn't the DTs. You know, I just dreamt about the DTs because I'm so concerned about the DTs. And anyway, on the fourth night, I think it was the fourth night, when I went to cold turkey, I came apart. My mind started racing. It just started racing, and I was shaking, and I ended up checking into a detox. I mean, I just couldn't stand it. It was just, I was coming apart from the inside out. Checked into a detox. They kept me in that detox for 5 days, pumped me full of Librium for the 5 days, and monitored my blood pressure around the clock. And during those 5 days, there were guys that had come in that were drinking, you know, for many more years than I was, seeing snakes come out of the wall and so forth, and they were in there for a couple days, and then they were discharged into the regular treatment center. And I thought, what the hell's going on? I'm in here, you know, I'm by now the fourth day or the fifth day, and, you know, these other guys are getting out early. And it was, this detox was attached to a treatment center, and I thought, I know what's going on. They're keeping me in this detox longer than I really need in order to convince me that I'm worse than I really am. So I'll go to their treatment center. And on the fifth day of the detox, they gave me a physical, and the doctor took me aside and sat me down and said, you know, started explaining to me about my physical condition. My physical condition at this time is I wasn't healing properly. I had bruises and cuts on me from, you know, just banging into stuff and falling down drunk and stuff like that. But they wouldn't heal. Nothing seemed to heal. And this doctor, she explained to me that that what was happening is I was starting to go through this liver failure, and that I didn't have cirrhosis, but I was getting awfully close or something to that effect. And I sat there listening to her, and again, it dawned on me. It's like, I know what's happening. This is like the treatment center closer. It's like on a car lot. You know, any minute she's going to whip out the documentation and say, sign here for the 28-day inpatient. And I did end up staying for the 28-day inpatient, and I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. And but I wasn't ready to hear anything. You know, I just wanted to not drink. If I could just get through alcohol withdrawal, and then I would stop on my own. And so about 2 weeks out of the treatment center, I drank a quart of beer one day. And after I finished that quart of beer, that's all I drank. I just drank a quart of beer. And I went home, and I thought, see, I can drink a quart of beer successfully. Now, the truth was, is that all I had money for was a quart of beer. But I wanted to drink so badly after that quart. I just didn't have any money to drink. So the next day, I just went on a major bender. And I just found this out recently, just within the last week. My ninth step, I'm done with my ninth step amends, I thought. But stuff just keeps kind of coming up occasionally. But last week I was talking to my mother, and we were talking about my drinking, and she was talking about kind of some of the things that she went through, watching me go to jail and watching me go to treatment and so forth. And she brought up this time, which I had totally forgot about, but apparently I was visiting her, and I got drunk, and then I got angry at my father. So my solution was to grab my shotgun and a box of shells and go up to his house and shoot his boat full of holes. And my father was out of town, but he had my cousin and her husband were babysitting the house, and apparently they talked me out of shooting holes in the boat. But so, you know, it's just like moral be revealed. I mean, I've got some people to make amends to now for that. But anyway, I got out of that treatment center, I started drinking again, and I'll give you an idea of what my life was like at this time. I could work for about 2 to 3 weeks at a whack, and then I would just blow up. And I would go, you know, I wouldn't show up, and I'd end up disappearing. One morning I came to, and I was working as a logger again on the Oregon coast, and I came to after this night of drinking, just this horrible night of drinking, and I was just like, I can't do it. So I got in my car, by the time I had my driver's license back, and I bought a case of beer. It was about 7 a.m. in the morning, bought a case of beer, drove down to Ashland drinking the case of beer on the way. I picked up two LSD salesmen along the way and freaked them out by my driving. I ran into the median a couple times on the freeway, and I pulled in front of a bar in Ashland, and I told them to watch my car. I just need to run into this bar real quick. And so I left the keys with the car running in a no parking zone in front of the bar, went in, ordered a pitcher of beer, and sat at this bar and started drinking beer, drank the pitcher of beer, went out, and my car was gone. And anyway, make a long story short, they'd stolen my car, and I called the police, and the police finally came around and picked me up. They put me in the back of their car, took me on the station. They said, you're in luck. We've got these guys. They happened to be driving by the cop shop right as we were coming to pick you up, and we have them pulled over. Well, I went to I was in the back of the car, and they were talking to these guys, and they came. The police came, and they said, you know, we're going to have to let these guys go because you did give them permission to move the car, you know, out of the no parking zone, and they just got lost while they were doing it. And I was like, you know, okay, whatever. And they said, but you have the right to remain silent. And they started reading me my rights, and I'm like, Why am I being arrested? You know, and they said, you have a warrant out for your arrest for an unpaid parking ticket. And I said, you're throwing them in jail for a parking ticket? And they said, you are covering one hand with one eye to not see double. You're either going to jail and sleeping this off for the parking ticket, or you're getting another DUI. What's your choice? Might as well take jail. Anyway, so I went into the jail, and I hit a bottom in that jail. And you know, this is about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting there kind of sobering up, and I threw a little fit in the jail, and then decided that the thing to do was to try to hang myself from the toilet with the sheets. And that didn't work. And anyway, they let me out that evening after I'd sobered up. And you would think, not you guys wouldn't think this, but normal people would think, that I would go cool off somewhere. But you know exactly what I did. I ran straight to the bar. And I had a story. I mean, I had a story to tell everybody. And I drank. And that's the way my days were going at this time. There was another attempt, a geographic, to try to cure my alcoholism. I went up to Ketchikan, Alaska. I went to work for a logging outfit on an island called Hecata Island. It's about an hour and a half float plane ride from the nearest bar or tavern, and it was a dry logging camp. No liquor allowed. So I got up there. I drank all the way up there, got on the float plane, went out to this logging camp. And for the next 3 weeks, I worked 6 days a week, and I slept on Sundays, and no big deal until two guys showed up with a bottle of whiskey. And they were in my bunkhouse, and they said, do you want a drink? And my mind very rapidly said, well, it's been 3 weeks. I haven't had a drink. I haven't even craved it. I'm probably not really an alcoholic. Sure, I'll take some. And they handed me the bottle, and I grabbed it, and I went, gunk, 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 gunk. And they grabbed it from me, and they said, hey, we got to make this last. And I thought we were going to drink the bottle. And they brought sipping whiskey. That's, you know. And so what happened is, because I suffer from the phenomenon of craving, I went and got in my bunk, and I had about the equivalent of about 3 or 4 straight shots of whiskey in me and no other alcohol and no way to get alcohol. And that phenomenon of craving hit me. And it was like an itch that I couldn't scratch. I just laid there wanting to drink. And so the next morning, caught a float plane into Ketchikan, and I quit my job, went into Ketchikan. There's a bar up there called the Fo'c'sle. And it's nicknamed up there, it's called the Fo'c'sle Snake Pit. It's a legendary bar where the loggers and the fishermen come, and they drink, and they fight, and they knife each other, and so forth. And I wanted to drink there. I was like, I need to drink there. So I went into the Fo'c'sle, and just to give you an idea what kind of bar it is, when you order a drink, if you order, say, Jim Beams, they don't give you a glass of Jim Beams, they give you a bottle of Jim Beams with a glass on top. And they have cots in the upstairs to, you know, so if you pass out, you can, you know, pass out upstairs there. And I started drinking in the Fo'c'sle, and I got about 3 or 4 drinks in me, and the guy that I was with, this guy that also quit the job and went into the Fo'c'sle with me, this guy named Dan, who was the nicest guy in the world. We sat down, and after he had about 3 or 4 drinks in him, he turned to me and he said, so you think you're pretty badass, don't you? And the night just erupted from there. And I ended up in jail that night, and I was a cop fighter, by the way. You know, every time I got arrested, except for the last time, I take some pretty good beatings by the police department, and justifiably. I mean, I had it coming. It wasn't like they were abusive. I mean, this night, and I'll give you another idea of how I was starting. I was losing touch. You talks about we can't differentiate the true from the false, and delusion and all this stuff, and when they arrested me, I was fighting so much, and they threw me into a holding cell, and they hadn't given me my orange jumpsuit yet, and I was naked, and they threw me in the holding cell, and I came in, and I was in and out of a blackout, so this is kind of pieced together, but there was two guys in the holding cell, and I immediately thought to myself, oh my God, I'm in the middle of Alaska, women are scarce, and they just threw me into this cell naked. So I thought the bright thing to do would be to walk across the cell naked and punch the wall and then jump and do about 15 or 20 push-ups, then put my orange jumpsuit on. And then I laid down on the cot and tried to stay conscious the rest of the night. And I passed out. When I came to in the morning, the guy on the top bunk was hanging off his bunk looking at me. And I looked up at him and I said, can I help you? And he said, my name's so-and-so. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, I've got 30 days sober, and I'm in here doing 10 days of jail time. I owe an amends. My sponsor made me come in and do jail time. And I sat there looking at him. I thought to myself, oh, my God, I can't even get away from these AA people in here. So, anyway, I left Ketchikan. They let me go after they took me to court. And as that plane was leaving Ketchikan and the plane was taking off, I thought to myself, never once I thought alcohol. I thought, I'll never come to Alaska again. And anyway, I went back down to Ashland. Well, I went down to Portland originally. And now this entered a time in my drinking where I was making desperate, desperate attempts to not drink or to control my drinking. And I've never been more miserable in my life. The despair when I'm giving 110% to not drink, and I drink every day. It's just unbelievable how painful that is. The despair, I mean, it was just, I was miserable. It was about the last 7-8 months of my drinking. And it was truly the loneliness, the loneliest and bleakest time in my life. And in January of 1987, I went down to Jackson County, owed 8 days of jail time for my third DUI. They let me do the jail time on weekends. I check in on Fridays and check out on Sundays. And between my third and my fourth weekend in jail, I got arrested. And on that arrest by the Ashland Police Department, they took me to the side and they knew me on a first-name basis and so forth by then. They said, you know, Chris, you've got a hell of a drinking problem. You've got to do something about your drinking. Go see this guy, Joe F. He's an expert on alcoholism. He can help you out. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll do that, you know. And so, anyway, the next few days later, I was, you know, walking around downtown Ashland, and there was this guy who used to stand on the corner with a Bible and would read passages out of the Bible to anybody who was passing by. And I was coming by, and I said, hey, Monty, I knew him from jail. So I said, hey, Monty. And he said, hey, you know, and he read something out of the Bible. And I took a few more steps, and I thought, somehow whatever he read was correlated with the Ashland Police Department telling me to go see this guy named Joe F. And I thought, hey, if I was one of those AA people, I would say, oh, there are no coincidences, and that this is God at work in my life, and that I should really act on this and go see this guy, Joe F. And I kind of smiled, and I took a few more steps. And then my next thought was, what if for once in my life I didn't dismiss that type of stuff as being stupid, and I didn't dismiss it as being trivial, and I actually acted on it even though I don't believe in it? And then I thought, yeah. So I turned around, I walked up to this guy, Joe F.'s office, and he originally wouldn't see me until I told his secretary what I wanted. And I said, you know, I have a problem with drinking, and wanted to see if Joe would talk to me about it. And immediately he let me in and sit down. And as I was leaving the waiting room to go into his office, all I could think of is, please not Alcoholics Anonymous. Please tell me that you went to aversion therapy, you know, 10 days, couple 2-day follow-ups. Now you've got 10 years sober and life's wonderful. And sure enough, it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And he did, you know, he did what we're supposed to do. He talked about himself. He told me a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. And at the end of doing this, he said, do you want to go to a meeting with me? Now, I didn't want to go to a meeting with him, but I had this weird sense of obligation that since I did ask him for help, that I should probably go. And I said, yeah, you know, I do want to go to a meeting with you. And he took me that night to a meeting that doesn't exist anymore. It was the Thursday night Clay Street meeting in Ashland. For those of you guys in Medford, it's this sister meeting of the Chipper, the Tuesday meeting in Medford, and it was the exact same format. And I went in, I sat in the back, and I raised my hand as a newcomer, and they what they did there when there was a newcomer, even if they had like a selected topic beforehand that they were going to talk about, the speaker and then the participants were going to talk about, if there was a newcomer there, they ditched the topic and they shared a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And then each participant shared a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And the speaker told their story about 20 minutes, and I identified a little bit. And then the first participant, and I identified a little bit there, and a little bit with the next person, a little bit with the next person. And all of a sudden, I was like, my God, these people drink exactly the way I drink. And then I was like, a little bit later, I was like, God, they think exactly how I think. And they feel the way I feel. And then there was this one guy that stood up, I think his name was Frank, and he said, he talked about coming out of a blackout with a revolver in his mouth. And then he went back into the blackout and came to the next morning on the floor with a revolver next to him. And that gave me goosebumps because that was my deep, dark secrets. I had the same story. I'd come out of a blackout, and I was holding a carving knife to myself. And I went back in a blackout and came to the next morning with on the floor with a carving knife next to me. Now, the only difference between his story and my story is that I also broke every dish in the house and knifed to death every piece of furniture in that house. And I was a guest in that house. But when he said that, I was like, my God, that's, I've done exactly the same thing. I thought I was one of the only free people that wasn't institutionalized that had done things like that. Anyway, what happened, because these people carried out the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, I identified with their alcoholism, and I came away for the first time with a little bit of hope. And the next day, I didn't drink the entire next day. And that was big for me because I was a daily oblivion drinker and I didn't drink the entire next day. Now, I didn't do anything else and I didn't go to any more meetings, so I continued to drink soon after that. And on February 4th, 1987, I went out one more time to prove that I could control my drinking or that I wasn't an alcoholic like the kind that was described in our big book or in the meetings that I had been to. My plan that night was was to drink 10 drinks. I was going to drink 10 drinks, and then I was going to shut it off at like 10 or 11 o'clock that night, come home, go to bed, get some sleep, wake up, and be like a regular civilian. And the guy that was supposed to go out drinking with me was running late, and I'd bought a short case of beer that he and I could have a few beers on the way to the bars. And he was running late, and I drank 9 beers sitting in my living room waiting for him. And so I kind of blew my plan before I really left the house. But I went down to one bar, and this is in Ashland. I went down to one bar. I remember I was drinking vodka Collins. I was in my normal state with one hand over one eye to keep from seeing double. I walked through. I would go through this back alley after drinking in that bar, up these back stairs into this Irish pub. I'd drink a pitcher of beer in the Irish pub, and then I'd go out the front door, walk across the street to this other bar, where they allowed me to do anything in that bar. And I finished my drinking in that bar, and I was drinking and drinking. And the bartender that night, I had one of those bright alcoholic ideas. As I was sitting there at the bar looking at him, I thought, if I was a bartender, I could drink and work and drink and then just walk home, and I wouldn't get into trouble. And so I asked Cliff, the bartender, I said, what's the... do I have an opportunity here? Is there a chance, And he assured me that I was a shoo-in for the job. And so I was, terrific, and I don't know what the details. I was starting to fade into a blackout at this time. What happened a little bit later is apparently, and this is all, I've been told, is that later in the evening he cut me off because of my behavior at the bar. And so I pulled him across the bar, the guy that my new employer, and was going to work him over on the bar, and he kind of weaseled his way away from me, and he grabbed a baseball bat, and somebody else grabbed me and took me outside, you know, and I was upset because I'd never been cut off in that bar before. I passed out in that bar one time, and they couldn't bring me back to life, and they started taking my vital signs because I was so unconscious, and they were in the process of thinking about giving me CPR, calling 911, and so forth. And when they started to turn me over to give me CPR, I kind of came to, and I walked, you know, I got up and said, and walked out into the middle of the street and held up traffic and urinated in the middle of the street, and they accepted that kind of behavior from me. But this night they cut me off for some reason. Anyway, police were called, and I found myself running through backyards, and the cops, you know, there was a couple cop cars, and they ended up, there was one on one street and one on another street, and I was kind of trapped between yards, and so I laid down behind some bushes and I passed out, and I came to a little bit later with them kind of nudging me a little bit with their toes, and they brought me to, and now I had snapped out of the blackout at this time, and they were in the process of talking to me. I don't remember what they're saying, but something happened inside. And this wasn't a very bad night of drinking, but something inside of me just clicked, and I don't know what it was, but I just couldn't do it anymore. And they hadn't cuffed me yet, and I thought, one of the officers was standing there, and his revolver was kind of near me, and I thought, I'm going to grab the revolver and shoot him and flee. And then my next thought was, now I get caught doing everything, I'm going to grab this revolver and shoot myself because I can't do this anymore. Before I could act on it, they cuffed me, took me down, so forth, booked me. Later, the next morning, they brought me home, dropped me off, or later in the morning, I should say. I ended up passing out in my bed. And that night, before I slipped into unconsciousness, my last conscious thought was, something's happened tonight, and I don't know what it is, and I wonder if it'll still be with me in the morning. And when I came to, it was February 5th, 1987, and it was still with me. And I have no idea what it was, but I couldn't do what I was doing anymore. I was through. At that point, death was a more attractive alternative than to continue living the way I was living. Had I had a crystal ball that morning, and I could have looked into it and said, if I just drink for another 90 days or another 6 months, I would have drank for the next 90 days or 6 months until death. But my fear is that if I drank another day or another week, that I would drink for another year or another 5 years or another 10 years. And I continue to spiral further and further down in this miserable existence I'd been living. I cried out to a God that I didn't even necessarily believe in at that time, and I said, God, please make this stop or kill me. I believe in a very crude way that morning I did steps 1, 2, and 3 without even knowing what steps 1, 2, and 3 are. I later formally did 1, 2, and 3. But I think in my heart, I had the principles and the elements of 1, 2, and 3. I surrendered. I surrendered. And I became willing to believe in a power greater than myself. I had, by the way, in my last year of drinking, I used to get vague spiritual desires. I would come to in the morning, and I had no idea that AA had anything to do with spirituality or higher power, but I would come to, and I would have this sense that somehow spirituality was what was the missing link. And I was raised Catholic, and I returned to the Catholic Church. But it just didn't click. There wasn't the bridge of alcoholism to bring me from where I stood to that spirituality. That morning, I became willing to do whatever it took to stay sober. I checked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me to do 90 meetings in 90 days, get a big book, start reading the big book, get a sponsor, start working the steps, start calling other alcoholics. They also told me to read this book called the little yellow one, Living Sober, and so I started doing this stuff, and I couldn't see the relationship between my drinking and the stuff that they were asking me to do. They were asking me to wash coffee cups. I was like, I don't want to drink. I don't want to wash coffee cups. I just don't want to drink. But I did it anyway. There was things like the Lord's Prayer, which I had a difficult time with. They'd hold hands at the end of the meetings and, you know, say the Lord's Prayer, and then, you know, keep coming back. It works. Which I thought was like the hokiest thing I'd ever seen. But I saw that the people that were staying sober were saying the Lord's Prayer and holding hands and saying, keep coming back. It works. So I did as they did. and the obsession to drink was removed. On February 4th, 1987, I was somebody who lived with an obsession to drink on a daily basis. And on February 5th, the obsession was removed, and it's never returned. And it's never returned, I believe, because of, one, because of that surrender, and two, because of the action that I followed up after that surrender. And anyway, so I got active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you this for the new people. I'm not somebody that came into Alcoholics Anonymous and said, I'm home. I love you people. I hated it. I hated the meetings. I sat there and I watched the clock go by. And I would just go, please, you know, I got to, you know, I could barely stand a full hour. And that was in this goofy morning meeting that I went to. The meetings that I did kind of like were at night, and they were an hour and a half. And but I knew that it was working, so I kept doing it. And, you know, and this group was very pro-steps, and I got into the steps right off the bat. One of the things that they told me was, they said, you know, if you don't believe in God, don't worry about it. All that's necessary for you to make a start in this program is to have a willingness to believe in God. That's enough. And they pointed out, you know, in the We Agnostics, it says essentially that. And another guy said it in a way, he said, you know, fake it till you make it. And another guy put it in a way that I really liked. He said, you don't have to believe in God to make a start in this program. All you have to do is start taking actions as if you believe in God. And so I started doing that. I started taking actions as if I believed in God. And little by little, a kind of an opening formed, and I started developing a relationship with something. In fact, when I was probably 60 or 90 days or somewhere in there, I was riding my bicycle to a meeting because I didn't have a driver's license, and my chain on my bike kept squeaking. Each rotation would go, squeak, squeak, squeak. Now, I had a very bad anger problem, by the way, before I came to AA. And every squeak made me a little bit more angry. But I just kept pedaling, and angrier and angrier and angrier. Until finally I got off my bike, and I threw it in a ditch, and I flipped God off, and I said, you know, screw you. And then I had that experience that, you know, that you hear about from people in AA. I got my bike out of the ditch, and I was like, if I don't really believe in God, why, how am I so angry at him? Yeah, and, but, you know, there was a series of coincidences that started happening in my life through taking these actions, and little by little, I started forming a relationship with a higher power. And at 44 days sober, I'd never had an anxiety attack before, and I had an anxiety attack. And I ended up in the hospital. And my secret, by the way, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, is I knew I was an alcoholic. And there's no getting around it. But my secret is that I was also crazy. And I didn't want anybody to know that. In fact, my first sponsor, I picked him because I heard him say in a meeting, he said, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. And I was like, ooh, that's, you know. But I had this anxiety attack, and I went to the hospital hoping that I was having a heart attack and that I wasn't going insane like I thought I was. And luckily, in the group I was involved in, they had warned me about doctors. And there was kind of a joke going around our group in 1987. They said that they should be careful because doctors have just discovered that alcoholism is caused by a Valium deficiency. And so when I was in the doctor's office, they, of course, offered me some Valium. But because I had heard that, I was like, oh, I can't have that, you know. And anyway, I got out of there. And on one hand, I was getting better. And I was building this relationship with God. And I could sense it. I could sense the presence of something in my life. On the other hand, I was still full of fear. I had all that restlessness and irritability and discontentment. Now, I hadn't done my fourth step yet. And everybody kept telling me that I should do it, but my mind kept saying, well, that doesn't have anything to do with it. You understand that I feel uncomfortable, you know, and there's something internally wrong with me. And they say, yeah, do your fourth step. And I'd be like, you know. And so on one hand, I seemed to be getting better. On the other hand, I seemed to be getting more and more uncomfortable in my sobriety. And I'll give you an idea of how uncomfortable I was. I was taking a psychology class at this time, and they gave us a stress test, kind of like an MMPI, some sort of personality stress exam and so forth. And it was an auditorium class. There was about 100 or 150 people in there. And we self-graded the test. And I was in AA now, so I was being honest, and I answered everything honest, and I corrected it. And at the end of the test, the professor, who is also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, said, "Who here scored between 0 and 25? And about 10% of the class raised their hand. And he said, "You people process stress very well. It's like stress bounces off you like water off a duck. Who scored between 25 and 50? And a majority of the class raised their hand. And he said, "You people process stress, you know, average, and you have no significant stressors in your life. Who scored between 50 and 75? And about the remaining 10% of the class raised their hand, and he said, "You guys have something significant in your life, you know, some sort of stressor, or minor but significant, and, you know, could just be a change in jobs or, you know, something." And then who scored between 75 and 100? And there was like four or five people that raised their hands. And he said, "You have a significant stressor in your life. You've either gone through a divorce or a death of a family member," or so forth and so forth. Who scored between 100 and 125? There was nobody. Anybody above 125? Nobody. Now, my score was 146. And, and the professor said, when he said anybody above 125 and nobody responded, he said, "I didn't think so, because the majority of people that score above 125 are institutionalized or in penitentiaries." And so that concerned me. And I went down to him after class and I said, "You know, doctor, you know, I scored 146 on this thing, and I do. I am going crazy. I feel like I'm going crazy." And he said, "Oh, Chris," he goes, "anybody in their first year of sobriety would score over 125 on the exam. What you suffer from is something called untreated alcoholism. You should consider doing your fourth step." And in my mind, I thought, "No, that can't be it." So about a month later, I was coming apart from the inside out, and I was getting worse. And I called the guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, "Oh, man, I'm really uncomfortable, da-da-da-da. I don't know what to do." And what he told me at that point is, he said something to me that drove me to a bottom. And he gave me some advice, which I think was ill-advised, or whatever they say. It was poor advice. And for me, it was. And I hit a bottom. And I wasn't going to follow the advice he gave me. And I'm grateful I didn't. And when I at that bottom, I thought to myself, you know, they've been telling me to do this fourth step over and over and over and over again. You know, I'm just miserable. I might as well do this fourth step. And the fact is I'm going to do steps 4 through 12 exactly as they're outlined in the big book. And when I get to step 12, if I don't feel any better, I'm going to commit suicide. And so I started in on my fourth step. My sponsor had me write a life story because in the chapter Into Action, it says we had to tell somebody our entire life story. He also had me do the, you know, the resentments and the fears and the sexual conduct in the fourth step. And I got to tell you guys that it was probably one of the poorest written in terms of form, four-step, or inventory work that I've done in my entire sobriety. But it was also the absolute best piece of writing I've ever done, because it came right from here and it contained every deep, dark secret that I lived with forever, and all the stuff that I had done, and the resentments and all these fears. And I got together with my sponsor, and I started to read this thing. And before I started, he did something for me, which I try to do for, well, I don't try, I do this for all the guys that I listen to their fist up. And he started out by telling me his deep, dark secrets. And he went bam, 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 and told me them. And my God, his were horrible. I mean, his were just unbelievable. I've listened to probably, I don't know, maybe 50 to 100 inventories, and I've never heard anything like this guy's. But it absolutely saved my life. It saved my life. And all of a sudden, I wasn't the only one that had done the things that I had done. And I read this fifth step to him. And somewhere between steps 5 and 6 and 7, before I finished the fifth step, actually, we took a break and I went into the restroom. And when I went to the mirror in the restroom, one of the things that I was accustomed to doing at this point, essentially all my life when I wasn't drinking, is I'd go to the mirror and I'd either tear myself down or build myself up. And I'd look at the mirror and I'd judge myself. And I would sit there and tell me everything that's wrong with me. This is what's wrong with me. This is what's wrong with me. This is what's wrong with me. My God, you know, why am I this way? Over and, or I'd go from the other side and say, this is what's right with me. This is what's right with me. You know, and try to build myself up, only to have that after about a minute or two sink back down and somewhere in my soul and go, nah, you are a piece of crap. That's just false stuff, you know, trying to build myself up. And I turned to the mirror to do this, which I had been in the habit of doing for a long time. And I looked in the mirror, and this feeling, the sense when I would do this always came somewhere in my soul. And I sat there and I looked at my eyes in the mirror, and nothing happened. But I started to experience a sensation that I couldn't quite register what it was. And I was like, well, what's going on with me? You know, I'm looking and looking and looking. And all of a sudden it dawned on me. I feel comfortable. And it was the first time in my life, for a long time, that I'd felt comfortable in my own skin without a certain amount of alcohol in my system. And I went back, finished that fifth step. I went and did step 6 and 7. And a few days later, I complained to a bunch of people that I did the inventory. Nothing had changed. And then a couple weeks went by, and I was walking down the street, and all of a sudden it dawned on me. I was just walking, and I was like, I feel at peace. I mean, and again, I was at peace. And I started, in my mind, going back to where this peacefulness originated from, and it was somewhere between steps 5 and step 7. And I didn't know this at the time, but on page 75, right in between steps 5 and 6, it talks about what I experienced. I had no idea it was there, but it happened. It also talked about the nearness of our Creator. We'll have a sense of the nearness of our Creator. And I started having that. Steps that, taking these actions that seemed to have no relevance to the way I drank, and also seemed to have no relevance to gaining access to a power that I could live by, gave me access to a power that I could live by. And that was at that time that I became a believer in Alcoholics Anonymous beyond just physical sobriety. And I do not want to minimize physical sobriety. The most important thing in my life is physical sobriety, not taking a drink one day at a time. But in order to have physical sobriety, I have to do all sorts of other stuff in order to maintain that physical sobriety. And I got into steps 8 and 9 because I became a believer in this program because of what had happened. I believed that Alcoholics Anonymous would remove the obsession to drink, but now I became a believer in it as a design for living. And essentially what I discovered is that, like said around Alcoholics Anonymous, is I found through taking the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous slowly gave me what alcohol gave me quickly. The difference is it was lasting and much, much better than alcohol. You know, alcohol brought me to as close to feeling as a part of as anything, except for the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous brought me closer and continues to bring me closer. So I got into steps 8 and 9, and I started making the amends and getting into action. And then I got into 10, 11, and 12. And my life just blossomed. I became a participant in life. The thing the magic of alcohol, you know, allowed me to participate in life, and the magic of this program really allowed me to participate in life. At 2.5 years sober, I had an intuitive thought through prayer and meditation. I had realized that all my life that I had not participated in things for the fear that I would end up being in second place and looking like a loser. So I wouldn't participate in anything. And I was kind of like, and the analogy that came to me was like a baseball player. I was the type of guy that would never step into the batter's box and risk swinging the bat for fear that I might strike out. And what I realized is that is normal people's definition of success and failure. The definition of success and failure for me is somebody that steps into the batter's box and swings the bat, and regardless of what happens, that is success. The only failure I can have is not stepping in the batter's box in the first place. And through that meditation and that intuitive thought, I ended up hustling up a job as a stockbroker. You know, I was somebody that was a daily oblivion drinker. I was uneducated. I, other than high school, I mean, I didn't have any college experience. I was a logger, and all I really knew how to do was drink and fight and, you know, and act bizarrely. And I ended up becoming a stockbroker. And I ended up, and I started practicing that, stepping into the batter's box and practicing the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in this job. And I'd like to tell you that I was just rocketed into this sort of success, but I wasn't. I struggled and struggled and struggled in that job. And I ended up ultimately hating that job, but I had financial amends that I owed. And Chuck Chamberlain, I'd heard say, you know, I'm just here to rub out a record. So every day I'd go into this job that I now hated to rub out a record. And I went in one day at a time to rub out a record. I ended up doing that. I ended up rubbing out that record, and I ended up owning 50% of a brokerage firm. And just my life unfolded in front of me. At 5 years sober, I met a girl in a tavern one night back when I was drinking. I was sitting at a table, and I had just explained to this other girl and her boyfriend about the affair that I was having with her, with this guy's girlfriend, and in a drunken stupor. And I saw this girl walk by my table, and then she walked by again, and I fell in love with her, and I started dating her in the height of my drinking. Well, that lasted 3 weeks when she kicked me to the curb because I was drinking so much. And when I was 5 years sober through a set of circumstances, we ended up, we were in communication, and through a surrender and so forth, it was a surrender. I surrendered. I didn't think I would ever have this woman in my life. And I surrendered, and the next day she called me from Los Angeles and said, I'm in love with you. And I have been for a long time. And a month later, we were together. And then soon after us getting together, now, I was somebody that if you, in early sobriety, that if you, you know, if you didn't have the DTs and if you didn't go to jail and you didn't drink the way I drank, I didn't think you were an alcoholic. I found out that that's totally false. My sponsor, a guy by the name of Cliff Roach, always says that 80% to 90% of the alcoholics that die of this disease are functioning alcoholics. They're people that have a job, they have a home, they have a family. Anyway, my current wife, she's the only wife I've ever had, but she wasn't my wife at that time. Ended up, she was an alcoholic. She was one of those functioning alcoholics, and I recognized it after her living with me for a few months. She stopped drinking and went crazy, and she got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're engaged to be married, and now I'm engaged to a newcomer. And I called somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, fully willing to do what my sponsor said, and I really expected him to say, hey, she shouldn't have any relationships for her first year. You've got to terminate this relationship until she has a year sober. But that's not what he said. He called him up and he said, if she was diagnosed with some sort of illness like diabetes, would you break off the engagement? And I said, no. And he goes, marry her. He goes, and if you have to go to Al-Anon, go to Al-Anon. He goes, but trust in God. He goes, God's bigger than, you know, some of these cliches that are thrown around Alcoholics Anonymous. Go with it. And we did. We got December 15th of that year, we got married, and we've been married for over 15 years, and she's been sober for over 15 years. And she's a very, very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She sponsors a bunch of women, and she's just a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous. Neither one of us know how to do a relationship. We have horrible relationship skills. But it seems like when I direct my focus to helping other alcoholics in prayer and meditation and trying to improve my conscious contact with God and cleaning up the wreckage of my present in the 10th step, and when she's doing that, it's as if God's doing for us what we can't do for ourselves and we're able to have a relationship, because neither one of us can do a relationship on our own. And so I got the woman that I always wanted as a result of just surrendering and letting this thing unfold in front of me. My my life is, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me to put first things first. And today, at 21 years sober, I have to put first things first. Alcoholics Anonymous is the absolute most important thing in my life. My entire life is owed to Alcoholics Anonymous. The way that I perceive people, the way I perceive life, the way that I conduct myself, everything is as a result of surrendering to this thing and these actions that still sometimes don't make sense. My biggest problem today is still self-centeredness and also this, in AA Comes of Age, it's referred to as the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. And I don't mean some sort of like big shotism or something like that, but what happens to me occasionally is that as I'm going through, because I the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous and I feel so good, that somewhere in my mind, very subtly, it starts to believe that I'm the one doing this. And that, and it's just not true. I suffer from alcoholism, not alcoholism. And what happens is I have to re-surrender, because today, as I stand here, my life by me is still unmanageable. And I'm also just as powerless over alcohol as the day I got here. And I've got a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of the spiritual actions and our spiritual program and maintenance of my spiritual whatever it says. I do know the big book, but up here for some reason. I'm not somebody that believes that alcoholism is something that's behind me. I believe that one inaction followed by another inaction followed by another inaction will ultimately result in this thought process that comes back, which is that insanity that precedes the first drink, that once again will tell me, if only I drink this way, I'll be okay. Or it's been 21 years, so I could probably drink again. And I went through a period at 7 and 8 years sober, which I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to close here in just a second. But at 7 and 8 years sober, where I did get dry. And that insanity didn't come back, and I'm so grateful it didn't. I went insane, but the insanity that preceded the first drink, and I learned that I had to maintain that entrenchment into these spiritual principles in order to keep what I've got. I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it saved my life and it gave me a life. And I'll close with something that Chuck Chamberlain used to say that's one of my favorite sayings, and that is, I've got two choices today, and that is, I can either live a self-centered life and suffer the consequences, or I can either live a God-centered life and suffer the consequences. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much.